All right, here we are, another episode of Let There Be Talk. It is, what is today? It's Monday, the 14th, and this episode is brought to you by my incredible sponsor, CBD Lion. CBD Lion, the best CBD products on the market. Gluten-free, vegan, organic, third-party lab tested. None of that fucking garage shit. This is the real deal, non-GMO. You got anxiety? What do you got? You got some pain? You're looking for some calmness? Are you suffering from insomnia? How about your pets? Are they going crazy? Get some CBD Lion. Use the code DEAN, D-E-A-N, for 20% off all the time, everything. I've been using this shit on my fucked up neck. I'm using the lotion. They got everything. They got the tinctures, the shatter, the gummies, and the vapes. You got you millennials that are vaping. And they got the gummies for you fucking candy heads like the old Dean, the old fat Dean. Anyway, CBDLion.com. Get the stuff. Use the code DEAN. All right. This is it, man. This is it. The return of one of my favorite humans on the planet. Probably one of the greatest and most underrated drummers, I still think, to this day. And
I've been called worse.
Oh,
I'll take greatest and most underrated.
Fuck yeah, man. I mean, Steve Gorman is here from the Black Crowes, formerly of the Black Crowes, Trigger Hippie, and all kinds of fucking stuff. But it's funny, I got to play with you last year when we did the Powerage tribute to Bon Scott.
Whereas my version is that I got to play with you. Easier to be Phil Rudd than it is to be Bon Scott, man. That was your night.
You know what?
You've hoisted a lot on those broad shoulders of yours, and you brought us all home.
Man, that was, you know, we're thinking of doing it again.
Better be.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was a blast.
I think the biggest fear I have is that was probably one of the most epic nights of my life. Mm-hmm. I mean, you play with Jimmy Page, so that doesn't fucking come close. But to me, to be up there and to play in a band with hand-picked dream band, you know, they got the fantasy fucking football leagues and all that.
Oh, hell,
bullshit.
They got rock and roll fantasy now, too. I mean, they got the fantasy, you know, if you got $8,000 and want to go.
Yeah, you can go play with dudes.
Go play with, you know, Joe Perry in Vegas and shit.
Yeah.
You know, he's got that going on.
Yeah, my fantasy rock band it probably took about 5 years off my life just from stress and shit.
Yeah, right.
But holy shit, I'm up there. And first of all, I had always loved your drumming. I had you on the show a few years ago. I just wanted to, actually, it's been like five years.
That was 2014.
Wow. Holy shit. I just want to get that out there so people don't go like, you didn't ask them anything about the beginning and all that. You know what I mean? Because it's like, just go back. Some people call it the best Steve Gorman podcast ever. So I'll take that.
Yeah, right on.
It was great. But there I am. It's you. It's Nikki Six, Scott Ian from Anthrax. Yeah. It's Josh Z killing it as Angus. Michael Devin on bass. We also had Bill Burr killing it for a few. who else? George Lynch. Marin fucking crushing Night Prowler.
Yeah, killing it.
Wow. I remember he didn't even want to play.
I know.
He was like, dude, I'll just do jokes. I was like, fuck you, you're playing, you know? And then he just fucking killed.
Yeah.
But and it's funny that you said I carried the weight of Bon Scott on my shoulders because another underrated drummer is Phil Rudd. People think it's just like boom, crack, boom, crack. It's like nothing. But
it is boom, crack, but it's a unique boom, crack. I mean, I've talked about AC/DC forever and we'll always talk about it. It's like, it's the greatest mystery to me is, did they sit down and all discuss, how do we take this vibe? Let's start with Chuck Berry. And let's add a few other elements to it. And then, but it's got a swing. It's got a rock, but it's got a swing. And of course, the answer is no. They just all, that's how they played. That's just what it felt like when they fell together. And the band was really something. But when Cliff joined, you know, from the minute Cliff Williams jumped in on bass, all of a sudden it really connected with a whole new level of, the easiest way to describe it to me is you can't do it. Anybody can play those songs. Yeah. Anybody that's got a rudimentary understanding of a drum kit can play what Phil Rudd is playing, but you can't make it feel like that. And a bass player can pound those eight notes all night long. You can't make it feel like Phil and Cliff. And anybody can play those chords. No one has Malcolm Young's right hand. No one's got ang. I mean, it's the whole thing. When you add it all together, it's so simple that it's impossible to replicate. Like, we all had good players on. It was fun, and we killed it, and it rocked, and yeah, it was great. But, you know, go into a studio and try to recreate the swing and the vibe of those records. It just doesn't work. That's the greatest example of the true. There really is chemistry between people.
Yeah.
And another band that's like that is the Ramones.
Yep.
You can't play Ramones songs. You can try, and you can play them correctly. Like I always say, I can play Ringo Starr's drum patterns, and you can go, oh, I know, that's obviously Ticket to Ride, or that's obviously whatever. It doesn't feel right. It's all about feel. At the end of the day, everything comes down to how does that group of people feel playing together, and how does everyone's effort can make a whole that's way greater than the sum of the parts. And AC/DC is one of the ultimate bands, at least for the first decade that they were making records, where that's just what it was.
It's funny that you say that because, you know, of course I'm a huge Black Crowes fan, and you know that, and we met years ago at Voodoo Fest, and it's the same thing with Black Crowes.
Well, sure.
It was chemistry, and its groove, and its vibe. And when I saw the Black Crowes, the first, when they got together, I think that was, I don't know, what, 2000 something, when they, at the New York shows before you're back in Atlanta.
Oh, 2005.
Yeah, so that's a perfect example of. And, you know, super fans, it matters. It matters who's in the band. To the surface fans, perfect example would be Foreigner out there with no one in the band, sometimes Mick Jones, but sometimes not. To the surface fans, it doesn't matter. And that...
Well, people want to hear songs they like.
They want to hear songs, right.
And it, at some point, it becomes a product.
Yeah.
And that's fine. I mean, what are you going to do on a night out? I'm going to go see live music. It's not anybody that was in the original band, but there's a lot of other things they could do. We'd go, dude, why don't you go see live music? I mean, option one, go see a band or go see a group, whatever. Great, do it. But there is always a line where is it a fun, like you said, the super fans that really commit to a band or to the bands they love. It's way more than
It's more than the song. It's more than She Talks to Angels.
Oh, of course. It's way more than that. And
the perfect example is what happens is, you see look at Aerosmith, still the same fucking guys.
Yeah.
Still playing arenas. Then you look at a band and you go, okay, well, these guys have got multiple divorces, or whoever we're talking about, bands out there.
Yeah.
They spend all their money and stuff. And it's just the county fairs meets the summer sheds meets the corporates.
Sure.
Casinos also.
Yeah, of course. And I don't begrudge anybody that's making a living playing music.
If you're paying
the bills playing music, you're gaming the system, basically. The way the world's set up, you're winning. So, you know, that's fantastic. But in the purposes of what makes bands special, it's all the stuff you just said. There's magic in the air and there's magic in the water. And sometimes bands are breathing and drinking it. And that's a glorious thing.
Well, what it does to me is there's a magic time to me in the Black Crowes where it was a band, and I don't even listen to the first record. That was just kind of like a gateway into the band that became something way more deeper.
Record was us taking we were saying, this is where we're trying to go.
Exactly.
We want to be a band. We weren't a good band when we made that record.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Johnny had been with us for a month. We'd played three gigs or something with him. Jeff had been there for 6 months. And we were a year into getting help from George DeCoulias. You know, George is the first guy who said, you do some things good, you do a lot of things bad. Like the idea of strengths and weaknesses and knowing the difference. We were brand new at all of this. And so that record, you know, we spent the fall of 89 going, holy shit. talk about going a little past the mark. Like we're not as good as this album.
Yeah.
Now, at the same time, we also knew all we gotta do is get on the road and we'll get there real fast.
Just like a comic.
Yeah, you just got to get out and do it. You need the reps. And we didn't have the reps. We didn't have an agent. We didn't have a manager. We had nothing. We would call clubs and say, can we come and play? And we weren't good at that. So it was just a matter of getting the opportunity. And so, you know, within a year, you know, one year after we finished making it, we're out opening for Aerosmith and we're a pretty good fucking band. And so the Black Crowes became that kind of a band on the Shake Your Moneymaker tour. And then when we went to make the second record, it went to a level that none of us, we could, again, we saw where we wanted to go, but then we actually got there while we made the second record. Like Southern Harmony wasn't better than we were. That was us. Shake Your Moneymaker was better than us. And then we found it and caught it and then passed it. And then from that moment on, we were just the kind of band that could go in and bust out a fucking record like Southern Harmony.
Oh man, you know, what I like to do is dig into a band like Black Crowes and then take it all the way as far as it could. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, God, this is great. Of course, people know that I love Three Snakes.
Yeah.
I was reading your book. You're like, Three Snakes, kind of weird or whatever.
Well, I don't attempt to separate my experience
right.
from the finished album, from the finished product, whatever you want to call it. That's not the point. Anybody, fans can talk about it all day long. And by the way, every fan's opinion is right.
Yeah.
Because trust me, I meet people all the time and they go, I can't believe you didn't like those shows in 97. I'm like, dude, I haven't listened to them. Yeah. If I put them on, I'm sure I'll be like, those are amazing.
Yeah.
But I only look at it. And I think my opinion is only of value if I'm explaining what it felt like to me. And what it looked like to me and what it tasted like to me. I mean, that's the perspective that I have. I'm not going to pretend to have an outsider's perspective. I just know that there was a great cost paid in order to get that band to the band that we became in 97, and it ultimately killed the band.
Right.
So I'll be the first guy to go, was it worth it? Fuck no. I told myself at the time it was.
Yeah, yeah.
But of course not. When you lose two guys in a week, whatever you did to get there wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
That's pretty basic shit, especially when you're talking about a band that never again found that chemistry, that was never again, it was always a good band.
Right.
Or it was a good group. A, it was never a band again, and a real one. And B, it was never that great again. So, you know, was it worth it? No, of course not.
Yeah, you're right on that, because fans, they're always hitting me like, hey, how do you like this or that? And it doesn't really matter what I say. I found that, like, I'll say what I want, and then it just opens this can of worms, and it's just like, hey,
well, I'm not running for office.
It's just rock and roll.
I'm thrilled if you don't agree. I could care less.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that to be dismissive. I mean, I literally look at it like, you bought a ticket, you bought a record, your opinion is right.
Yeah.
you know, if you haven't seen the band, don't say shit to me about it. But if you know, I mean, the other night, where were we? Oh, I was in New York last week. And for my new radio show. So I was over at Westwood One talking to all these salespeople, like, you know, hey, I'm Steve and thanks for selling the show, you know, shaking the hands and meeting people. And at the end of the meeting, one of the guys who had been there kind of quiet, he came over and he goes, hey man, I just want to tell you, I saw 52 shows.
Yeah.
And I was, and I so sincere, I said, God, man, thank you so much. I mean, cause I immediately, in my mind, I don't know if this guy has a family, but he probably does. I don't know if what he was doing. And I don't know that he didn't tell me the first one was 90, the last one was 29, whatever. I just know that to get anybody to 52 shows. Now, there's people who've seen a lot more.
Yeah.
But and I think they don't mind me saying this, they're fucking crazy because they have made this commitment and it's beautiful. But the average guy who loves a band for a variety of reasons, the majority of people who love a band can't go see 35 shows a year.
They barely see one.
That's what I'm saying.
It's unbelievable.
The majority of a band's fans, I still see people who say that Black Crowes are my favorite band. I saw you guys three times, man. And it's the three best nights of their life.
Yeah.
I don't value the guy that saw us 100 times more. I mean, I don't look at the guy who saw us 100 times and think, you're more important to me. Now, you can say very directly, well, that guy did more for the band. I mean, a fan who saw 100 shows, I'm beyond, I mean, that's truly humbling. I mean, I literally say what I was getting to the point, the guy in New York, 52 times he had to figure out a way to get to the gig. 52 times he put something into play in an otherwise life that probably was rolling along, where he's like, okay, well, I'm changing this and I'm moving this around and I'm reserving this and I'm doing this 52 fucking times.
Yeah.
And I told the guy, I can't ever thank you enough for that. I mean, that's incredible to me.
It is.
That said, the guy who says, I only saw you three times is the three best nights of my life. I say the same thing to him. I'm so glad that we were able to do that for you. I still, you know, because I can be the guy that used to see REM and just drive home in a fog.
Yeah.
Because I'd seen my religion. That was my religion for a few years, you know. The guy that first saw, you know, any number of bands that just changed my entire chemistry, you know, like, okay, I'm a different person now from that show.
Absolutely.
I know how that feels. It still is. It's the greatest thing in the world. But, and obviously when I'm talking about giving my opinions and telling you what I think in the purposes of having written a book about it, when I'm writing the book, I'm totally cool with people that disagree with the way I see it. It's great.
Awesome. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, it just,
it's one of the five guys.
I love that people love the music. I love that people love the band. I love every bit of it. I'm just grateful for all of it. But I'm also, there's no reason to not say what I really think anymore. And there was an awful lot of, in the band, like most bands, there's a closed door society there. And in any group, any family, any office pool, anybody where there's addiction, active addiction, what you end up with is a shit ton of secrets.
Yeah.
Everybody closes ranks for a variety of reasons. It's first of all, there's a lot of things that are embarrassing. You just feel like, I don't want people to know this. And then there's just, this guy's in a weakened position. I got to have his back. It is a family. And a family with addiction has a, there's bubble wrap around the world you create. And there's codependency. And there's loyalty, and then there's broken loyalty, and there's trust, and there's blind trust, and there's all these things. And so, but all that's gone now. The band is, there's no black crows.
Yeah.
For me.
There's no black crows.
And so there's no reason, I have no reason not to just be completely honest. And about my own shortcomings as well. It's all in the past. I can see it all right now with more clarity than I ever could have. When you and I met 5 years ago, there were things I knew that I didn't tell you.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't. It didn't make sense to. There's nothing like that now. It's all put to bed. Like when I met you 5 years ago, I knew Chris had already blown up the band, but I didn't tell you that.
Yeah.
I didn't say, oh, by the way, our singer demanded all the money and we broke up. I said, well, I don't know if we're going to play again. You know, it's more like that.
Yeah.
Because at that moment we were still processing it, going, what the fuck just happened? And then you're going, dude, when's the next tour? And I'm like, yeah, I don't know. But
well, you know, I always hear the rumblings. People come at me and they're like, Chris wanted all the money. And
he didn't want all the money. He wanted 75% of the money.
Which was your money and his.
He wanted all of mine and then some more of Rich's.
Right.
Yeah. So he wanted 75%.
Yeah.
And he was offering his brother 25%. And kicking me to the curb.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's just what it was. I mean, there's no reason not to say that happened. I mean, he doesn't want me to say that.
Yeah.
But why wouldn't I say that? That's what happened. That's why the band ended.
I called you immediately when I finished the book. I was in Vegas. I'm that type of guy. Ooh, Vegas. That's where I'll catch up on some reading.
Yeah.
I was like, what? I'm going straight to my room. Got to read.
Yeah.
I can't stand Vegas except for performing there. So I dug into the book. And of course, Bill Burr was like, did you read it yet? I go, no, man. I'll read it next week because we both got it at the same time. He's like, get on it, man.
Burr was funny. He crushed that thing in like 2 days.
Yeah, I did too. Yeah. Once I got on it was funny. I was doing the spots and then I'd go upstairs. But I had played music most of my life. And as I read it, I realized, and I called you right away. If you read the book, you're going to be like, well, why didn't you just quit each time? And and what happens is, and I used to think it was a curse. I used to think a small thing would dangle and then boom, I'm in for another 2 years.
Yeah.
And then a small, but now that I look back on it on a pleasant mind, I would say, I think, man, that's some kind of universe keeping me in going, keep fucking going, man, keep going.
Well, listen, in any endeavor, when you look at, if you're writing code, if you're a software designer, if you're a poet, the people that you look to as inspiration, all of them at one point thought this is never going to work, but they kept going. And what they say to everyone is just don't quit. Just don't stop. And so when you find yourself in that place, you're like, well, I can't fucking stop. Now, the black crew, now my situation was different because we had already succeeded.
Yeah.
And so it's like, well, how do you quit something that's working? And is that, and there's a lot of stuff in the early 90s that I, when I'm talking about how I was struggling, it's because I'm, you know, and a lot of that's like, fuck, this is me. I'm the one that's, what's wrong with me that I'm not just enjoying this? Well, nobody was enjoying it, but I was internalizing everybody else's shit too.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, success was a mirror. Like it afforded me the first time in my life to go, I'm not worried about the rent and I don't feel good. So fuck, I got to deal with myself now. And so I put that off for a while, like you do, but I eventually did have to face it. And it was traumatic and painful, but it was overdue because again, you know, most people, 23, 24, 25, 26, by the time people are turning 30 in the quote unquote real world, you would hope there's been a few, they've had their shit kicked out of them a few times by life. And it's like, hang on, what do I really want? Am I in a rat race for no reason? Blah, blah, blah. Well, we all had that, you know, by our early 20s, we were all like made men.
Yeah.
And that's confusing as shit. When you don't admit it's confusing, you make it worse.
Especially when you didn't even play drums like a few years before.
Yeah. Well, yeah. 3 years from the, I bought the kit and 3 years later, yeah, my record's in the stores and it's selling. That. It was like, yeah, hey, this happened pretty quick.
Man, that's got to be kind of crazy, right?
But yeah. And you know, it's funny because the bands that followed us, like the, for lack of a better term, the grunge bands, for example, when they met huge success, they had no problem admitting to the world, I don't know what the fuck this means. I'm confused. Eddie Vedder and Kurt Cobain were fucking freaked out about it and didn't mind telling you.
And that was part of the whole thing.
And it connected, but they were sincere in that. They weren't cynical about it. They were like, I'm not inspired by arena bands. I like club bands, and now I'm an arena artist, and I'm fucking... Well, that was the same thing that happened to us, but we didn't admit it. We were on a different track, and it wasn't in our nature. It certainly wasn't in Chris's to go, I'm fucking freaked out by this. This is way more than I bargained for. No, we were like, fuck it. We picked up the ball. Let's run this fucker. You know, let's be rock stars. Let's be huge. Let's be, but we never let, but we always wanted to be great first. To our credit, we did say, well, we got to be fucking better than everybody now. And so that part was good. But all this to say, it all makes perfect sense to me now. It's 30 years ago.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
at the time, man, it's just, we did not do ourselves any fucking favors. We did not admit that we felt vulnerable ever, and it's what killed the band. I mean, it's one of the many things that killed the band was our own reaction to our success.
One of the greatest stories in this book is, I feel that
let me hold on,
yeah,
because I got off track. You were talking about why don't you quit, and you thinking about that in your
right
trajectory. So for all the people who've been in that place and you're trying to make something happen and you're asking yourself, why am I still here? Why am I still here? You know, the answer, and I would, I don't know, you know, if someone hasn't read the book, I don't want to give too much away because I of course want people to buy the book and read it.
Of course.
But, well, it was my band. I mean, I wasn't a guy that was just brought in to, you know, I wasn't miserable at work. It was my life.
Yeah.
I mean, it was my primary concern, focus, and motivation every single day of my life was the Black Crowes. And, you know, and the band was built upon friendship more than we have a musical vision, let's find it together, because we changed our vision dramatically when we met George DeCoulias. And we all agreed, well, whatever we're doing together. And so those words resonate with me to my fucking marrow of my bones. So I'm on the team. I am like, you know, we're playing till the buzzer goes. We're on the team here. And so when that starts to go awry, it was completely counterintuitive for me to say, this is bullshit. I'm out of here. My thing was always, it's up to me to fix it. I'm not going to be the guy to give up. I'm not going to leave. They're not going to beat me. And again, you know, now I look back and go, what the fuck is wrong with me? That's, you know, that's classic codependent behavior.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And I'm in a room of addicts, or not everybody, but there's enough of it going around where I'm immediately like, I got you, man. Let me help you out. And it's like, no, let me help me out.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to do that.
Yeah. I love the sixth member in the band, Pete Angelus.
Sure.
Pete Angelus is a manager, as I read this, a lot like a Peter Grant. He He made shit happen for this band. A lot of times treated like shit, but grinded through it, got stuff. One of the great stories in here, and I remember it very vivid when it was happening, was the ZZ Top no sponsorship,
yeah, right,
lip syncing war. And it was amazing to read how this is some genius management, and I love him and David Lee Roth together, what they did, you know, over the years with Van Halen and then into Roth's solo career. But it's genius to go, hang on here all the way till I can tell you when to put the hammer down.
Right.
That shit was incredible.
Well, Pete looked at everything, bad, good, and different, as what is there an opportunity here? And it's not an opportunity. He's not an opportunist in a negative way. His job is to, I don't want to speak for him, but you know, he's an old school manager in the sense of job one is protect the artist. No matter what, you take the bullet every time. You make sure that the artist doesn't hurt themselves. Now, of course, talk about throwing yourself a gauntlet, signing the Black Crowes, and then trying to keep them from hurting themselves. And it proved to be impossible for even Pete. But initially, you know, he was able to, much like George did with just the music, Pete looked at us and said, okay, I see three things. I see four. Okay, I got five things you guys are fucking amazing at. And we're going to stop everything but those five things. Just stop them right now. Blah, blah, blah. Whatever they are. I'm speaking figuratively. He didn't literally have this conversation. But his way of doing it was to say, guys, just do this. Like, you know, it's going to be a while. The first album, he said, we might be on the road for 2 years. And you're just going to stay in one lane. But at the end of that 2 years, we'll be able to expand it. And we'll be able to grow and expand it musically. Anything else you want to do. Other projects, creatively. But for right now, the more we hammer this first record home, the more doors it opens for the rest of your careers. And it's all very true, and nothing that any of us thought like or understood in 1990. And by the end of the Shake Your Moneymaker tour, it was like, oh shit, man, he was right. Like, we did what he just said, just trust me on this. Let's go. And we did. And then we were able to do a lot of different things because of that. And then we had a lot of opportunities because of that. And a lot of those opportunities we didn't take advantage of. But I'm saying from the jump, he had this understanding of the industry. It's not rocket science. Plenty of other bands have done this. He just said, guys, this is how we do it if you want this to work. And then, you know, it got cloudy because by the time we were finishing the tour for the second album, you know, it was just impossible to get a consensus on what to do anymore. And suddenly, you know, Pete was looked at as, look, you're just here to manage, you're not here to give us input. Well, which was suicide, because he gave us a tremendous amount of creative input from the jump as a team player. I mean, he looked at it like, I'm not on stage, but you said he's another member of the band.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like this is the number of bands that can say bad management, bad lawyer, bad label, blah blah blah, that killed them. We didn't have any of that. We were surrounded
By
all the good people. I mean, we had people willing to do whatever it took at whatever their job was to help us. So we were very, very fortunate in that regard. And Pete was a business and creative. He's a brilliant guy.
He really is. Amazing.
And I'll tell you one thing that I didn't put in the book. I thought about it. I think I actually had it in there initially. And I just didn't feel good about it's a memoir. It's not a history. It's a memoir.
Right.
So I didn't call anybody and say, hey, correct me. This is how I remember it. This is how it happened.
Yeah, yeah.
And if somebody's you said May, it was April. Okay, sue me.
Oh, I hate when people do that.
But this is how it went down. There was one thing where I almost called Pete to ask him what he thought. And then I thought, no, if I have to call him, I know the answer, which is he wouldn't dig it. But like, Pete Angelus wrote us a letter in 1990. He wrote the band a letter and sent individual copies to everyone's house in 1996, where he just said, guys, there's like five pages. Hey, this is what's happening, and this is all going sideways, and this is like a fucking flare in the night.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to get this across, but this is not, it's not about radio, it's not MTV, it's us, it's you guys. This is you. You are destroying this very thing that we all built. And I still have it. And I read it when I was writing the book. And it now, with all the hindsight, the only thing that floored me in this whole process was reading that letter.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy shit. I mean, we even had a guy writing us a letter to go, just take 15 minutes and please read this. And we never, ever had a group conversation about it. Fuck. We still couldn't.
That's crazy.
And everything he wrote in the letter was true. Every prediction he made happened. Everything he accused us of, so on the money. And when I read that, I decided not to do it. That at some point, though, I did call him. And I said, hey, sorry to bug you. You know, I don't know what you're doing. I'm imagining you're happily doing whatever the fuck you want.
Yeah.
But I don't know if I ever even mentioned, do you remember this letter you wrote? And he's like, I kind of. And then I started reading. And he's like, oh, fuck. But I called him. I said, man, fucking thank you, man. I mean, I've always thanked the people that, I mean, I'm very good at saying, you know, fucking well done. Don't know how to repay you. Because it's true. We had so many people that did so much work on our behalf. But I called him specifically when I found that letter. And I was like, motherfucker, how dumb were we that it was right there in front of us, you know? Here's the problem. Here's all the solutions, blah, blah, blah. Just totally ignored.
I loved some of the early stories because it really makes me reminisce about old band days.
Sure.
There's nothing like the trip you guys take to Florida in that shit car and it catches on fire and stuff. Yeah. Those are the look, I kind of got goosebumps from it.
Dude, that's the whole, that's when.
That's the nucleus, man, of rock and roll.
That's truly what forms and keeps alliances. And I don't mean alliances like in some Game of Thrones bullshit. I mean, like, for me anyway, I got back from that trip and I was in the fucking army. You know what I mean? Like I'm going to war. We are ready to go. Whatever it takes.
Yeah.
And then you have all those and then even once the Black Crowes were the Black Crowes and we were, you know, once we were an established band, we still had some moments like that. And it's like, hey man, in a fucking pinch, man, we're still all right. We got
each
other.
The fight in Denver.
Yeah.
You guys got to fight these dudes, and it's like, these guys are brothers, man.
Yeah, man, of course. You know, it's like you have these things and for, you know, the trip to Florida in 1987 bought us several years. A fight in Denver, hey, it bought us a couple days.
Yeah.
But those couple days felt pretty fucking good.
Yeah, you're hey, we're back on track.
There's other stuff that I wrote that's not in the final book, but there's a lot of anecdotes that weren't necessary to keep repeating the same thing over and over. Right. But like there's a whole thing about, like in 1990, we did the MTV New Year's Eve gig. And it was MTV New Year's Eve. It was Cinderella and Vanilla Ice and Wilson Phillips and the Black Crowes. It's in the book a little bit. But there was a whole exchange in the hallway where it was me and Rich and one of the girls from Wilson Phillips, Carney.
Yeah.
And she was walking down the hallway and her dressing room door was locked. And we were just standing there. And she was a little, she wasn't like a real social, hey, what's up, guys? She was a little drawn inward, you know. And she found herself stuck outside a door that she couldn't get open. And she was a little embarrassed, and then she was forced to talk to us.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, there's no great punchline coming. The point is, me and Rich, in our own way, both, we had a million opportunities like that where the different band members, we just all had a similar shtick. We were all Fletch or Bill Murray in Stripes. We were all those characters.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, hey, guys. And we were like, hey, how you doing? We both just took on these weird personas and we had a very awkward conversation and we wouldn't break the awkwardness and it just got weirder and weirder and she was really uncomfortable and we weren't being mean, but we were kind of being mean because we were just letting it linger forever. Yeah. And every time it seemed like it would end, one of us would say something else and it was just one of these things. It doesn't mean anything, but we go into our dressing room 2 minutes later and we just look at each other like, man, that was fucking funny. But we don't even have to say a word to each other. But that's what keeps groups together. Like there's moments like that. There's millions of them.
Yeah.
You know, there's me driving the van and I would always fuck with people at toll booths. Yeah. I would always say the weirdest thing. I would like sit there and start a conversation and they're like, dude, drive. You already paid. You know?
Yeah.
But those little things, everyone always got to laugh no matter what. So like you're in the middle of the worst, dumbest band fight. But it would immediately, oh, here comes a toll booth. You know, like, okay, fuck it. Yeah. This is good.
Yeah.
I mean, and there was so much of that, and that shit was even going on in 2013. I mean, there's just, you're looking for the laugh always. I say in the preface, all that, a lot of that laugh, it was all fueled by a desperation to have laughter.
Like, yeah, oh yeah.
It wasn't healthy.
It was, but just it, bottled up.
It like, was real, but it wasn't real good. You know, yeah. If you know what I mean. Yeah. It wasn't healthy, but it was necessary. And so, but like you said, dude, I mean, you have just as many stories I do about get a band together, get a room. I'll say, hey, this is actually good. You start playing a few gigs.
Oh, yeah.
And some weird shit happens, and you're all fucking bonded after that. That's everything.
And still guys will call me to this day, like, they'll just call me out of nowhere and go, dude, that time you did this, man. Oh, yeah. And then I just start laughing like, fuck, man. It really is. And I got a lot of that with comedy now in the last 10 years.
I can only imagine.
Just being out on the road and seeing the same shit stuff from the ground all the way up. You know, it's wild. I really enjoyed, or I didn't enjoy it, but I was like surprised by the Japan meltdown.
Yeah.
You're in Japan and that's it. You finally
I had another one 6 years after that that wasn't Black Crowes related at all. I've had two, what I would imagine they're nervous breakdowns, where I completely just lost the plot and felt like I was oozing poison for days, crying and can't get my shit together. The second one happened in 1998, and it was a reaction to, it was delayed reaction from losing Mark and Johnny a year earlier and just not stopping for 1 minute. Like, nope, let's get new guys. Got a new label. Got to get a new producer. You know, we were just like, go, go, go. Don't stop. Do not wonder. Because when Johnny quit, I was blown away. And then I was blown away that I was blown away. I knew it was coming, and yet it stunned me. And yet I wasn't prepared for it. And I knew that Johnny and I in 1990 started the conversation of, when are they going to fucking ruin this? They're like, when is this going to end?
Yeah.
Well, and to his credit, at some point he started preparing for that, and I didn't. Yeah. I was like,
do you think in your mind that you thought he wouldn't quit because you constantly wanted to quit, but you just didn't? It was just chatter.
I knew it wasn't chatter. I knew it was a different level with him. I mean, for several reasons. But the fact that he got sober and stayed sober in 96 and 97, right. I mean that was
on that in that era.
That's the deepest and darkest of the drug use in the band that I'm aware of. He was sober as a judge and kept to himself and was just like, I saw him on the bus or at the venue and that's it. Like the thing of us on days off hanging, that was gone. I never saw him at the hotel. You know, I literally wouldn't see him unless we were on our way to the venue or leaving a venue.
And other band members too? It was just like everybody.
No, Johnny was just I would still see the other guys. Yeah. More, you know, but
so like, he was just staying out of the fire.
He was well into his own world. And then that whole, you know, we had talked a lot about it, and then it still blew my mind. And you know, in 2001 when I quit the band, I told Rich several times I'm quitting, and then when I quit, he couldn't believe it.
Yeah,
it's same thing that I went through with Johnny. It's like it's like Pete's letter. It's like, dude, there's smoke in the room. Like,
you
don't
you
open a window. Don't open a window. Put the fire out. Yeah. You know, like or whatever. But we just, you know, it was just a thing of. And so anyway, to get to the point, so a year after Johnny left, I found myself, I just hit a wall again. And but what came out in that one was all family stuff, personal stuff, me and my wife stuff. It was just, it was way more personal. Some of the Black Crowes stuff just opened that door. But what came out in 1992 in Japan when I really unwound was all my fears and anxieties and frustrations and expectations. It was all just the band. And what does it all mean? And I don't think it means shit. I think we're kidding ourselves. I think we're not being realistic, and I think we're setting ourselves up for disaster. But I don't know how to fix it, and I'm afraid to admit it because what if I'm wrong?
Yeah.
And what if I'm just chicken shit?
Yeah.
And what if everyone else is fine? And all that. 1998 was, who the fuck am I? Just me. Like, get away from this. What have I allowed myself to become, and why am I at odds with myself? And what does that mean for my marriage? And what does it mean as a son and as a brother and as a friend? I mean, that was a much more, I'm 33 and I haven't really grown up yet.
Yeah.
And so that was that. And both the result of both of those, and especially the one in 98, was tremendous clarity and peace compared to anything I'd ever felt before. And like, I was a real OCD person, like crazy OCD.
Yeah.
And I that stopped on a dime in 1998. I had a cathartic 3-day freak out at home one day. I mean, I started on Friday and I was still going on Monday, and I couldn't stop talking and crying and losing my shit.
Wow.
And man, I'm telling you, when it was over and my wife hadn't run in fear and panic, she was still sitting there talking to me. Yeah. Like, what else? Bring it. I mean, my OCD shit, it just went away. Like, oh, okay, cool.
That's a good woman, huh?
Oh yeah.
Oof.
So that part didn't make the final cut. It didn't really serve a purpose in the grand scheme.
Of course, another meltdown,
it was a brutal, and I did a lot, it was a tough situation to be in. When I say I did it to myself, what I mean is I didn't have the tools to deal with it. And then it took me a long time to admit that I needed some help. I finally was like, fuck, this isn't natural. And I don't have I'm not smart enough to make sense of this. That's when it all started to get better.
It's interesting. I've had Mark on the show a few times. I had Rich on, and I did know that Mark, of course, is a full-blown heroin addict. Mm-hmm. No secret. Been battling that shit for years. Mm-hmm. He's got a lot of demons, and thank God he's still here alive. But holy shit, did that guy get dark. Because in the book, you said Ed was a pro-drug taker, and I would see that too. He was just drugs and totally normal. And there's people out there like that. They can drink. You ever hang with a guy and they can drink all night and they never fucking get loud or want to fight
I did a year,
your back?
I spent a year on the road with a Welsh band called Stereophonics.
Yeah, there you go.
Professional drinkers.
Yeah, just normal.
Incredible.
And Ed was totally that type of guy. But then Mark... wow, man. I knew it was dark out there. Of course, I saw those tours.
Well, yeah. No, it's awful too. I mean, there's a difference. Like you said, Mark got demons. He doesn't have there's not a mean bone in his body. There's not a bad.
He's a beautiful human.
I haven't talked to Mark in a few years, but. The last time we spoke, it was about a session on a Mark Morton album I had played on. And he was like, guy from Lamb of God. And hey, do you think Mark would play on this? And I was like, yeah. And I called Mark and he's like, yeah, give him my number. And so it worked out. I think we're on the same song, but we didn't track it together. But anyway, I haven't spoken to Mark. And the watching him go through these things, and we weren't close. We got along fine. We never had a problem.
Yeah.
I tell a story in the book about going to Japan and I'm ready to murder him in the drive in.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a story about me.
Yeah.
Mark's drunk and happy.
Yeah. That's a classic story.
See, that story to me is look at that. Like it's funny. Cause how fucked up am I that I'm mad at this guy for enjoying his first big tour? That's 100%. Just to give you an indication of how fucking far off the plot I've become, that's why that's there. It's nothing against Mark. He's just doing what anybody would have done.
Absolutely.
And so, but that said, it was, when I say we weren't close, I mean, he and I never had anything like I had with Chris or Johnny or Rich, because Mark stepped into the band when it was already the Black Crowes.
Yeah.
And there was just no way we were ever going to have that connection.
Is that because
because
it's like the golden ticket? Do you feel he didn't earn it? I mean, even though he became
He earned it real fast because he elevated the band at such an intense degree.
Yeah, and, big time.
And it's, in a way, and this is the thing, you back the chemistry. It's not about what Mark played. It's about what Mark played and how it impacted what everyone else did. And the overall sound, it's... and it was also his vibe, his persona. The first time we played with Mark ever, I remember thinking like, oh my God, he's amazing. But I couldn't have envisioned him in our band. It just didn't make sense to me. And that went away about 9 minutes into his first rehearsal with us, though. It's like, oh fuck. Yeah, done, over. Yeah. Never look back. How could you? It was just too, it's like, I mean, it's literally like saying, you're going about your business and you're trying to, you're trying to paint the ceiling and a 7-foot guy walks in and goes, I got that. And it's, oh, that's so much easier, you know, or whatever. There's some bad analogy. Yeah,
I don't have to worry about that corner anymore.
Yeah. And so it just, again, everything with chemistry in a band, there's confidence. Live music is, Paul Stacey said this once and I never forgot it. Playing live is 95% confidence. 95% is confidence. The minute you stop thinking and just do it, then you're a musician. And there was, Ed was unquantifiably responsible for the growth of the band in 91. And then there was, I didn't know how much farther we could go. And then Mark stepped in. It was like, oh, that's how far we can go. Holy fucking shit.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing that people, and Ed and Mark are properly given huge credit. What's easier to miss is what me, Rich, and Johnny figured out along the Shake Your Moneymaker tour. Like, we weren't that great in 1990. By 1992, that rhythm section was fucking ferocious.
Smoking.
And then it speaks for itself where Chris went as a performer and everything. So, but Ed and Mark, you know, but again, you look at that band that's on the cover of my book.
Yeah.
And you just go, okay, that's a troubled group of people all hanging on for dear life. But motherfuck, when we plugged in a room, that was something that you can't. That's what you can't describe it. You can just experience it and think, well, thank God it happened. You know, because that was a special fucking band.
Oh my God! I mean, you know, I think I've seen the band. I don't know, 71 times or something. There's a reason. Yeah,
you told me that I think after we had done the first podcast, and I was like, oh, I didn't know you were one of those. Fuck, damn, dude! I was fucking respect.
Flying all over, seeing the band, you know, massive bootlegs, tape trading, and all that. It was just it became my life, and it also became a textbook of learning rock and roll and all kinds of stuff, songwriting and mystique and danger and live performance and everything. And it changed
and
game.
All of it, you know, the thing too, everything you just said, I agree with. And it's all the pain that I went through and all that struggle. See, it was worth it to a point. It was totally worth it. To be a band that was operating as a band.
Oh, yeah.
And sacrifice is a huge part of any group endeavor. And I was willing to sacrifice a ton. When people say, well, what were you willing to do to keep it together? I'm like, fucking everything, because I did. It's only when we stopped operating together that's when the question, like, what the fuck am I doing here? And that's from 96 on. That's just what it turned into.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, the things you talk about, like there were some really, really brutal stretches in 93 and 94 and 95, but we were still able to go on stage and just wherever we went together and we knew it and we felt it. And that was always like, okay, well, I mean, again, if you put a gun to my head and go, well, we're going to give you everything you want, but it's going to take this. I'm like, oh, sure. I'll sign that piece of paper.
Yeah.
You don't have to threaten me. I'll sign it.
Yeah.
Done.
Yeah.
It's just one, but, you know, not everybody remembered that it's about chemistry. It's not about one or two. It's about six.
Yeah.
When,
well,
when it was about six, it was unstoppable.
Look at me. I'm like a super fan and I followed it all the way through. But by the time it gets to By Your Side, I was like, ah, man. And then I really enjoyed, a lot of people don't like Lions. I really enjoyed that era. I loved the Brotherly Love tour with the Oasis.
Yeah.
I went a bunch of those shows and then back, even if it wasn't, like you say, wasn't the original band of, it was never the same after 96 or whatever, but back when you were back in that first run of all
2005 was pretty great.
Fucking smoking.
Really good.
Smoking.
Yeah.
By the time the Fillmore run happens.
That Fillmore run.
Ooh.
When we did the Fillmore run, two things happened that week, and it's par for the course, the high and the low. Running concurrent, you know, they're riding partners basically.
Yeah.
And it's the questions, who's in the sidecar today and who's on the bike? The good or the bad, you know, the black or the
white. Right.
But they're always riding together with the Black Crowes.
Yeah.
Those, was it five nights that first run?
Yeah.
In 2005, I remember like being at one of those nights, like after soundcheck, I walked around the corner to a Starbucks and there was a fan, a woman I had said hi to over the years, and she and her husband were there, and they're from back east, and she's like, I'm buying your coffee today. And I was like, great, thanks. And that little thing, I remember, like, I walked away going, we've done it. We patched this boat and got it seaworthy again, because that's a longtime fan and she feels it. And she just had this vibe about her that I swear, like, I hadn't seen since Three Snakes. Like, yeah. I am fully committed to this again, and I can tell the band is. And it was just, it's hard to explain, but it's the strangest thing. But I remember walking back into the Fillmore with that cup of coffee going, man, we're fucking doing this. This is actually happening. And those gigs were all fucking incredible.
They were next level.
And the last night of that run, and we're going to Japan the next day.
Yeah.
The last night of that run, we go out and we play, and then we go do our encore. And then we go backstage, and then I think we went out and did an extra, totally unexpected encore. And the place is going ape shit. And then we leave the stage, and they turn on the house lights, and they put on the music. What the fuck? What's the song?
Yeah, Green Sleeves
yep. comes on. No one leaves. No one stops chanting and stomping. And they just don't do it. And eventually, the guy at the house turns the music off.
Oh.
And 5 minutes have passed, and we're all in this dressing room. And everyone goes, fuck, let's do it. Let's go, let's go, let's go. And Chris goes, no, I'm done. And we're all like, dude, one more song.
Yeah.
And he goes, I'm fucking finished. And everyone, you know, Mark, Ed, me, Rich, Sven, and Pete, and Amy, everyone's in the room like, what, dude, this is like a, no, this is a thing. And I think Rich said, we haven't played Sometimes Salvation since night one. And I go, and I remember I said, if we go play Sometimes Salvation right now, the room will literally explode. And we, come on, let's go. And everyone's like laughing, like, dude, this is fucking crazy. And he just took his shoes off, said, I don't, that fucking crowd's not going to tell me what to do. Like, literally, just like that. And everyone just went up. He's in the downstairs dressing room. The rest of us all just walked upstairs.
Yeah.
In like this, you know, it's like, what the fuck?
Oh, like, man.
And it was like, that's like, it had been a really, you know, up until then, there hadn't been one of those. And then it was like,
there it is. There it is.
Oh, my God. What the fuck was that?
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then that fall, we were great again. And like, we wrap up in Chicago on Halloween. It was fucking awesome. It was all, you know, it was just, but it was like, you know, there was that first shot from the bow, man. Here it comes. Yeah. It was just that darkness. It just rolled in. And
it's wild how many times... How many chances he's got in the biz? As far as like,
well,
there's that fuck you to Robert Plant. There's the fuck you to Aerosmith. There's the fuck you to ZZ Top.
I think there's a lot of, there's a lot of reasons you could say. I mean, for one thing, when you know he was great.
Yeah, totally.
It wasn't a guy from a hair metal band that had one record saying this shit. He's spouting off, at least he was a great singer and a great writer in a great band saying it.
Right.
That just buys you more rope at the end of the day. He also, I think, just doesn't give a fuck. That helps.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's,
that is a front man.
You can burn a shit ton of bridges when you don't even notice, when you don't give a, I don't mean it like, hey, good for him, but to his, I guess, credit, when you don't even notice that you're burning bridges, you don't notice that you're burning bridges. You don't care.
Yeah.
And he always comes back around. I mean, the other thing that I think that, you know, is I think Game recognizes Game. You know, he called out Aerosmith. What could they say? He was right.
I get it. Yeah.
You know, and
it was
so
on that sober tour.
There's just times when you're shooting inside your own house, it's like, okay, well, dude, you know, we're not crazy about all this, but we still got your back, but now you're shooting us. You know, eventually it's going to wind itself down.
Right.
But, you know, it's just, but that music, man, people fucking love that music, you know?
Oh,
I mean, that's what it comes down to. It's like, And I do think that you, like we said earlier, you talk about bands that move from a band to a group, which is what we did, and then eventually it's just product, and it doesn't matter who's doing it.
Yeah.
And that's where the future lies. But that doesn't take away from the fact that it once was special, you know?
Yeah. I mean, Well, that's what's going to roll the ticket sales.
Dude, the Lakers didn't make the playoffs last year.
Yeah.
You know, they were still fucking pretty good in 1988.
Hell yeah.
Shit happens.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to talk to you a little bit. First, one thing I didn't know was that Rich played all the guitars on By Your Side record.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I had no idea because as I was reading the book, I was like, wait a minute. I'm reading this thing and Audley wasn't in the group and I'm a Black Crowes freak and I don't know why I never even noticed who played on what or whatever, but I really, really loved what you talked about before you did the By Your Side record. You guys went in and did your own record.
Yeah, band.
And
amazing.
I love the band and the Tall Sessions. Mm-hmm. I think it's some of the greatest Black Crowes stuff. And I love that stuff like Pain and Eight and Don't You Forget This Song and Thunderstorm.
I never cared for that Never Forget This Song too much.
Yeah.
But that was the only one. I think the rest of it on band... Pain and Eight, Another Roadside Tragedy, and Peace Anyway, I put those three against any song we ever came up with. They're all fucking fantastic. And that whole session to me, even there's a song Predictable and Life Vest are the two sort of lightweights.
Great.
They're great tracks. I mean, the band, just the feel, that's what I thought. There were some epic songs, Wyoming and Me and Smile. I mean, and My Heart's Killing Me. Those are like the three best ballads we ever had.
Smoking.
They're fucking amazing.
Smoking.
And I hated losing that record. And it's one thing. It's funny because in editing the book, I talk about, we were out of options and we ended up doing By Your Side. Everything was different. The fact is, once Johnny and Mark left, we couldn't have played band. We couldn't have put band out with a new band.
Because they played on that.
Oh yeah, that's
right,
everybody.
Exactly.
We did that before Further. Right. We did that in the spring of 97.
Exactly.
And so that was the group that was just home from the Three Snakes European tour, which was fucking brutal.
Oh.
And that record to me was, and again, just I can't separate. If I listen to it now, I might very well go like, okay, well I can see that's a little pushy on the chorus. This is the, you know, I'd pick my own parts, pick apart my own tracks or whatever. But I just know that what it was that was like this last incredible gasp of like, oh no, wait, hold on. We're actually still here when we want to be. Because it was very focused and very clear headed and as sober as anything we were ever going to do. You know, Mark was clean right then. Ed and Chris were barely doing, I mean, it was just real focused. Let's do this without any pressure. And it was fucking great. At the last thing I expected, too. That always helps.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when
you're like, let's go in here.
You know, when you go into a restaurant and you see it's got a D from the health department, but then it's the best meal you ever had, you're like, holy shit, that was great. You know? Yeah.
I mean, each time, it seems like every third chapter or something, I would be like, what the fuck? But really, on that CBS deal, man, really blows my mind. Like, you had to just turn in another record and you would get like another $3 million or something. And then something happened and that went away.
Oh, the V2 deal.
Yeah, the V2 deal. That was it.
Oh, Well, there was a timetable. It was like this was in the summer of 2001 and under the terms of the deal, we just had to turn in our record, you know, within a year by the summer of 2002 to get the next. To keep the deal in play.
And it was big money.
It was $1 million per record. It was pretty crazy. And Chris wanted to go do a solo career.
Yeah.
And just, you know, the way he is, the idea of doing a solo record and the Black Crowes record in the same year, he just literally was incapable of even considering that.
Yeah.
And that doesn't speak to him being an asshole as much as it speaks to him just being incapable of understanding that that's possible.
Yeah.
He's just not that person, you know? And it just, that was the, and again, I'm at a place where I tried to quit in 99. I literally called to quit and Jimmy Page just wants to tour.
That's a classic.
And then by 2001, that summer, I was like, okay, yeah, cool. I'm glad this has been cool. It's all good. And, I'm leaving without malice and anger. It's just time, you know, clearly. And then I'd already made that decision and was, you know, as far as I could be anyway, at peace with it. And then when Chris said all that and just said, oh, I'm done. It's, you know, I don't care about the deal. You know, it was kind of like, well, I've clearly made the right decision.
Yeah.
You know, because this is not a band.
Yeah.
This is a this is just keeping people's lives going as opposed to being a functioning creative endeavor anymore. We're, you know, there's no sense of camaraderie or teamwork. It's right. just everybody's getting what they can from it. And I can't do this anymore.
It's funny when you look back at on bands, where they are now and they have to do something that mm-hmm. they wouldn't have to do if they would have just played the cards right as well, far as money deals.
Oh, well, it's well, that's a whole nother book.
Like,
you know, instead of like just tilting at all these windmills and running after all these things that like we don't actually care about, like, you know, to me, like, I looked at a lot of the things that we did as we're so, it's so easy to be a band that simply we were in a place in 1992 where we could have called our own shot forever. We were leaders. We were our own entity. We were this thing called the Black Crowes. And Chris used to say on stage, "We are the Black Crowes." And that's all he had to say. He didn't have to explain what that meant. And people always used to say, "That's so cool when he just says that way." Like, it meant, it was real. It was tangible. It meant something to our fans. And eventually, and all that talk about, you know, the evils of the industry and all this, it's like, dude, they're not, no one cares.
Yeah.
The industry's not attacking us. Like, promoters are working with us. That's how that works. We can't promote our own show. We have to work with promoters. The record company is getting our record played all over the world. That's okay. It's not bad. If you don't like it, like, again, like, we, you know, there was always this understanding of if we just set our own course and let the chips fall where they may, we're going to be around forever. But when we respond to every external bit of information and when we let things pressure, like I always said, like, we're a motorboat and we just keep putting up the sails.
Yeah.
Fucking, why are we letting the wind blow us?
Yeah, we've go got way faster. Fucking,
we got some engines.
Yeah, yeah.
And we just go where the fuck we want. We're the Black Crowes. Who fucking cares about anything to do with the music industry? We're above it all. We take from it what we need.
Yeah.
And as long as we set our goals, we can go be, that's what I mean about leaders. Like, you know, it just didn't need to be such a, it wasn't a quest. It wasn't, we weren't at war.
Yeah.
But what happened was when we lost the ability to all communicate and be on the same page, you lose the ability to just all, you, when you can't go together, you don't go anywhere. You know what I mean?
It's like, oh yeah.
You know, faster alone, further together. And that worked for about 2.5 album cycles and then it was done.
Oh man. I love the book. It's called Hard to Handle, everybody. You got to get this, even if you're not into the Black Crowes.
Hard to Handle, The Life and Death of the Black Crowes.
Yeah, The Life and Death.
The original working title, Hard to Handle, The Official Autopsy Report of the Black Crowes.
Oh, fuck.
I thought that was kind of, See, to me, that's just like funny. And then, of course, people are like, well, that doesn't read funny. I'm like, okay, I'll take your word for it. I was going to dress like Quincy on the cover. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Blood splattered
Quincy,
medical examiner.
The old TV show?
Yeah, the medical examiner. Yeah. Body on the slab in the back.
I got a couple questions. I always thought about the Black Crowes. Of course, I'm a deadhead now.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't a deadhead for most of my life. Now I love them. But there was a point where he said, Chris gets way into the Dead. And uh-huh. Same with Rich. When I had Rich on, he goes, this ruined it because then Chris wanted to be the Dead. The Dead people didn't respect Chris, you know, but he was like, we're part of this thing. I think, and I truly believe this, 100%, if the Black Crowes would have just stayed where they were going, they were the Allman Brothers. They were the next Allman Brothers. And the Allman Brothers are gone now. There's no more Allman Brothers. And the Black Crowes would have just slid into that spot and still been able to be a jam type of band.
Yeah. A rock band that jams.
Right, right.
Which now, is very different than a jam band that can rock.
Right, right. Because I can't stand jam bands. I love the Black Crowes. They really were my introduction into some jamming, and I love the Dead. But they're playing around beautiful songs. Jam bands are just some frat guys.
Of course.
Hey, let's just, they have no songs, and they... So I do I do think that the Black Crowes truly would have slid right into the Allman Brothers slot and been playing right now.
Yeah, I do too. Well, I think there was like, you know, the band and Little Feat, they never punched their tickets. You know what I mean? Yeah. The Allman Brothers fell apart. Dwayne died. They had I mean, they were bigger than ever after, but eventually they ran aground. With those bands didn't have like Pete. They, you know, they didn't have someone who was fully capable of keeping them wherever they wanted to go. The problem was that we couldn't get where we wanted to go. We couldn't agree on where we wanted to go. That's the problem. It was always internal. And I was never suggesting to re-record Shake Your Moneymaker over and over and over. I love Southern Harmony. I thought Amorica was great. I loved where the band was going because it was moving together. When it got splintered and what tore the band apart. And when I say it tore the band apart, it didn't tear it apart. What eroded the band? It's a drip drip effect. It's a slow erosion of that spirit, of the sense of we're all here together. When one person's ignoring what's patently obvious, which is, hey, everyone else doesn't like this. It wasn't just me.
Yeah.
No one wanted to go as far down that road as Chris wanted to go. And the thing is, it's really easy for me to see now. And it speaks to whatever issues Chris might have with himself. We saw Chris as the man in 1992 and 93. There wasn't a better frontman in rock music when he was motivated. He found himself on the tour for Southern Harmony. The band found its real essence to me. Those songs and the ones we wrote on that tour, Exit and Bewildered and The Fear Years, and there was this progression. And Nonfiction and Girl from a Pawn Shop and all these things that were written in 92 and 93, Cursed Diamond. There was this, those songs, Song of the Flesh and Dirty Hair Halo. There was all this music.
Yeah. Feathers.
Feathers. Title song. Fucking insane.
Title song. Those two. Come on, dude.
This was us. Yeah. This was like.
Original sounding.
It was just, we were just this thing. It was happening. And at that point, all the tension was worth it. The fights were worth it. The bullshit was worth it because we were doing this shit. Like, we had become this band that was far exceeding what 3 years earlier we would have hoped to be. And I don't think Chris could. I think there was an issue with, you know, he has a huge ego, but mostly huge ego means there's tremendous insecurity. Those go hand in hand.
Totally.
He couldn't see his honest strengths. Because then he would feel like, oh, I'm just full of myself. But then it's so hard to put into words, but you could see it like if he could have seen himself the way we saw him and just taken a breath and been able to accept, yeah, I'm far from perfect, but this is unique. And clearly leading the direction of the band, but at some point it just goes way too far. And the fact is when it was obvious and when everybody's saying, hey, dude, we're not digging this. This isn't us anymore. His response was, you're wrong.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, that's actually not true. Like, you know, no, how can we be wrong when we tell you how we feel?
Yeah.
But for a little while there, it was truly, and again, from 92 to 93 through 94, just the songs we wrote, most of which, half of which were never put out, but they were all, that was just this time when it was, every piece made sense. The Venn diagram was perfect. And I don't think he could ever see himself the way we saw him, and therefore he could never see the band the way we saw the band. And it's I'm not mad about it. It's just sad. I mean, I couldn't have written this book before Ed died. You know, when Eddie died, in the few months following, suddenly I was like starting to write, and I was like, "What am I doing?" And I literally one day I went, "I think I'm writing a book."
Yeah.
And what happened was, I think now again, this is now fucking 3 years of hindsight. All of my anger and bitterness, which I had plenty of, and I had been working through, you know, I didn't fucking finally get into therapy till 2016. And I went twice and went, well, this is 25 years later than I should have started. Yeah. But, and it didn't take long before it all, you know, I was like, oh, the best thing I ever did for myself.
Yeah.
By the time Ed died, all I felt was sadness and gratitude. I'm so appreciative for all of the good shit. And I'll always be sad that we didn't come close to what we could have been. And it makes sense to me. I'm totally cool with it. And Ed's death was just this final, I thought I had peak finality, But there was one more level to go, which is Ed died. And then it was like, oh, I can write this book now because I don't feel, I feel okay. I'm fine with it all.
Yeah.
It literally sits. It makes perfect sense that this is how it went. So I can do this because I didn't want to write an angry book or a bitter book. I wanted to write a book that was filled with appreciation and love and sadness and gratitude. And that's what that book is to me. It's fucking forever sad, but it's not mad anymore.
I feel, this is what I truly feel about Chris as I've watched him over all these years and have hung out with him a few times and everything. I truly believe, somebody told me this early on in my comedy career. It helped me big time. I was doing some kind of stuff that wasn't necessarily me. And they said, watch out what you get famous for. Because those are going to be your fans. And I feel, and this is just my look on it from being on the outside, I feel that Chris got famous for a southerny, she talks to angels and MTV era and all that.
Sure.
And and then later he falls in love with the Grateful Dead, but he's boxed into this thing and it's tormented him forever.
Well, that's, and again, that's probably, well, I'm sure there's truth in that.
Absolutely.
But we weren't, in 1993, 94, we weren't in any box. We were actually more like the Dead at that time than ever before, because the Dead were unique and their own thing, and so were the Black Crowes. And he couldn't, I used to say to him, in 1995, we opened for the Dead in Tampa, and there was some conversation. This wasn't a heated argument.
Oh, that's the bootleg downstairs.
It was just a conversation about the Dead and the Black Crowes. And I said something to the effect of, dude, I'm buying your stock over Jerry Garcia's in 1995. I go, what? We are what the Dead were. Don't you get that the Black Crowes are that? Like right now, what they once were and what they've become, we're on our own trajectory. And then 3 months later, we're opening for the Stones. And we're like, we're not going to be the Stones, but we're on the same. What the Stones were and what the Dead were they're the Stones and they're the Dead. And all you got to say is those words and everybody knows what the fuck you're talking about. And that's what the Black Crowes were in 1995. They were on their way to being that. And it wasn't enough. He still had to go, you know, it was like, but I think that whether it was more about fame, I think he struggled with the fact that our first record, we were just aping the Stones and the Faces and Humble Pie.
Of course.
So what? We had to find ourselves.
We all wear it on the sleeve.
We wore it on our sleeve proudly. Yeah. I mean, people be like, you know, you sound like the Stones. I'm like, thanks.
Yeah. Great songs, though. You can sound like the Stones and not have any songs.
I used to say all the time, at least we don't sound like Bow Wow Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be worse. If you're going to tell me we're ripping people off and you say the Stones and the Allman Brothers and the Faces, I'm like, fucking right on
we are.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And by the second record, that was all moot anyway.
Yeah, that
didn't
was
matter.
Completely
and,
gone by
and,
then.
And so when I say we were leaders, I mean we were our own lighthouse.
Yeah.
And I think that Chris was way more comfortable just be, like I said, we were a fucking... We were a battleship, and he wanted to be a sailboat. And it's like, dude, just put the engines in the water and let's set a course and let's all go together. And when we did, when we went together, we went deep. And then when we couldn't go together, it's just what it was.
Well, we're sitting here today in the middle of your book comes out, and here we are in the middle of a massive. Black Crowes back together.
Mm-hmm.
You and I and of course industry people have been hitting me for months and months and months. This is happening.
I've been hearing about this since, what is it now? Where are we? Like probably May or June?
Yeah. Some fucking asshole on my Twitter was like, I knew once Neil died, there was good. This is why they brought the Black Crowes together.
This was going on way before Neil.
Summer tours don't happen because a guy passed away.
No.
You know?
Well, no, not at all. And this was, you know, I was hearing about this long before that.
Yeah. Same here.
Just to put that to rest. And I don't think that Neil's name or memory should ever be associated with, I mean, that's horrible to think that that's
I'm the
oh,
same way
Neil's gone so no
I know that's no, no I just connection. Wrote to the guy one I usually don't respond to people like that, but he said, I told you, you know, this is all has to do with Neil, and I just wrote nope. You know, people are so fucking dumb. CRB was already going on hiatus, mm-hmm. you know, a long time ago. They announced it. We're going on hiatus. Yeah. We're not going to tour.
Well, look, I mean, and I don't know anything more than you know about their tour for next year, other than it's happening according to every fucking person that I know. That's going on.
Yeah.
And like you said, that doesn't happen over the course of a weekend.
It doesn't.
This is obviously, it's been cooking for a while.
Yep.
And I mean, we were talking about, you said something about Foreigner earlier. It's like, cool, great. If that, you know, I think they've both painted themselves into corners, and this is what they have to do. And yeah. I think that if it's going to mean people keep listening to Black Crowes music, I'm all for it. Great. Yeah, yeah. I mean, shit, everybody that reads the book goes, oh, I went back and listened to the records. I'm like, awesome.
Yeah.
Great. Those are some fucking good shit there. I'm fine with that.
Let's clear a couple rumors. There was a rumor that Live Nation offered more money if you were in the band. Is that true?
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah,
it would certainly stand to reason, but yeah. that's not happened.
So you've never heard anything from the brothers hey, will you come if it's there? You're not even on the table.
No, and that's not going to happen.
Yep.
If that were going to happen, that would have already happened. Well, put it this way. The point of a tour in 2020 is not to put the band back together and go make great music.
No.
Because no one's called me. And as far as I know, no one's called Mark. And no one's called Johnny or Sven. You know, there's not a thing of let's be a great band. I don't think that has anything to do with this.
Yeah,
thing that they're thinking is, let's share money with Steve. I mean, the reason, you know, I can't imagine what, you know, well, I can imagine, but you know, the thing ended, we were set for a 25th anniversary and farewell tour in 2015.
Yeah.
And it ended because Chris blew up the band. I mean, there's no reason to think that this makes sense on any level other than, you know, we need to do this.
Yeah.
So we're going to do it. And that's fine.
Go ahead.
Knock yourselves out. But there's no, I mean, I've already been involved with enough Black Crowes music that wasn't, you know, honest, and what, it wasn't a band anymore. It was a group, and it was a great gig, and we had great nights, and we were occasionally we touched the stars again.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's not happening again. If you did put the original band back together, do you think it could ever be as good as it once was? No.
Yeah.
No, it's not possible.
I think too. It's. I think it'd be good for like one run and then I don't know, because and if I'm going to be super honest here, and I always am about that band because I fucking loved it.
Yeah.
I thought the last run was absolutely the worst, and I'm friends with Jackie Greene and but that thing was hideous, that last run, just in my eyes.
Sure.
And that's fine. And yeah, exactly. I'm not saying it in an anger way. I was just this is just.
Listen. Yeah. That at the end of 2010, the last show at the Fillmore in 2010.
Yeah, I was there.
If you had said you guys ever playing again, I would have laid my house on no. Not that's it. That's the end. And that sat okay with me because we had gotten really good again. It wasn't the same as 94, 95, but that band in 2010 was a legit, that's as good a rock and roll band as was playing at that time. And it was very different, but you know, the stuff we had recorded it for what it was, it was, I was cool with that being the last chapter of the Black Crowes.
The Before the Frost record.
Yeah, that
I love that record.
The War Paint, that record, and Crowology, then that tour.
I love all that stuff. It was just the live stuff.
The tour, then 3 years later, we go out with the 2013 tour.
Yeah.
Was definitely a, are we sure we want to be done? Maybe we need to do one more. And then it was apparent to everybody as we were putting that tour together. Well, let's at least go out. We got to do 2015, because if we do the 25th, then we can just end it well. We can end it on a high, and not necessarily musically, but we can at least show respect for what we've done and each other. Like, my whole vision for that tour, everything I saw was all about the last night. I wanted to finish a set, and I wanted to walk out on stage. I wanted to shake Chris's hand. I wanted to shake Rich's hand, and I wanted to shake Sven's hand and Adam's hand and whoever the fuck was playing guitar.
Yeah.
And, you know, in my mind, we would have just fucking gotten Mark back and done it right. But then I wanted to go see Pete and Amy, and Drew and all the crew. I just wanted everybody to go, okay, this has not been easy, but at least we finished it like with some dignity and some self-respect. That meant everything to me, and it didn't happen. And it didn't happen for the most embarrassing reason imaginable, which is that Chris just demanded all the money. It's profoundly, it's just so, it's yeah. Literally, that's the word. It's so embarrassing. Well, how come your band broke up? 27 years in, our singer decided to take all the money. It's like, no, that's just, what a fucking shit show. So all that said, there's but it was a great service because I have not looked back. It was
You're in a way better spirit now than when you sat down here 5 years ago.
Oh yeah, no,
there was
dude,
some fresh anger there.
I've been able to just you know, it's funny because when that actually happened, my show had just gotten picked up nationwide. I was way in over my head with a national sports radio show that I wasn't, you know, I got an opportunity. The guy liked, and the show turned out, it got good. It wasn't good at first. And I was like, when you and I first met, man, I was like, yeah, I got this radio show. And fuck, actually, when we met, it was coming together. But those first few months, when Chris blew the thing up, I was like, I can't believe that happened. Fuck, I got to go to work. I got to get this show to, I was busy. That's the thing. A year later, one day I was like, what the fuck was that? You know, like once I calmed down and then with the radio bit and then Trigger Hippie put out a record and went on the road. And then that was immediately apparently like, oh, this isn't going to work either. Like this lineup's not staying together long and we can't do anything together. And so in the summer of 15, I pulled that, I was like, stop, this is no.
Yeah.
So I was like, I just lost two bands in a year. Like, what the fuck? I was laughing about it. I go, man, is it me?
Yeah.
And like, holy shit, what's going on?
Yeah.
And then by 16, it was all starting to make, it was all, you know, but like I said, the second I started therapy, just the act of doing it was changed everything. And then not to mention that I just got to look at some shit I wasn't aware that I hadn't dealt with yet. So this is now 6 years for me really the last Black Crowes show, there was these corporates. It's five and a half years since we played a note of music together. And I say this sincerely, that feels like 10 or 15 years. And the reason it feels like longer is because the last shows we were playing and the last tour we played, there wasn't that connected musical level. There were moments where we connected on a very human level in 2013. In ways that we hadn't ever before, in fact, that I still am very appreciative of. There were some moments that really, that will always be very important to me. But the band on stage, that wasn't happening. And I knew it wasn't going to, I wasn't looking for it. It was all okay. It was like, that's okay. So, but that being said, it's very different than when I left the band in 2001. I quit at the end of 2001 and, you know, that was a year after we had been playing with Jimmy. It was only 4 years after Mark and Johnny had left. Those 4 years felt like 50.
No, oh, man.
The last 5 years to me feel long because they felt like 50, but the emotional connection in 2001 to 97 was still very visceral. My emotional connection now is so far gone. I mean, I'm on my second radio show and I'm on my second Trigger Hippie album and I've written the book. The book was all written in my head 3 years ago.
No,
it takes
great.
A while to get it out on paper, but everyone keeps going, this must have been really cathartic. And I'm like, no, I already did all this.
Yeah.
You know, so it's very much in the rear view. I like it right where it sits. It's fine. Go with God. You know, it's like, I'm good. All of it to say, and I'm sorry that not everybody who came through the Black Crowes got out in good shape. You know, it took me long enough to get into good shape.
Yeah.
And I wish the same could be said for everybody. And I certainly hope that anyone that's not there gets there.
Let's talk about the new radio show. You got a new radio show out.
Steve Gorman Rocks is on the Westwood One Cumulus Networks. It's a nationally syndicated classic rock show. It's 7 to 12 Eastern on the East Coast. It's 5 hours a night.
What
Monday
night?
Through Friday.
Oh, Monday through Friday?
Oh, yeah.
Holy shit, you're doing it every night?
Yeah.
Where do you do it? Do you do it during the day, every day?
No, it's right now it's live. I mean, I'm in there. It's a lot of it's 10 songs an hour. It's not a lot of my content is, you know, 8 to 10 minutes an hour total.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And so it's stories, interviews. It's just whatever we put together for the show.
Right.
And it's great. I'm not selecting the music. I'll pick themes for shows, but classic rock is a format that it's, if anything, it's moving into the 90s. You know, like we play Black Crowes.
Of course,
I'm just
talking about it.
We play fucking Green Day now. Yeah. There's Nirvana.
That shit's classic rock.
Smashing Pumpkins. You know, there's 90s music now in the format, but there's still a lot of 70s. That's obviously mostly 70s and 80s.
70s is oldies
now. But the 90s, yeah. But the 90s is, but you know, the 60s is just Hendrix and Zeppelin.
Yeah.
The occasional Magic Carpet Ride. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
but Break On Through, Light My Fire, maybe.
The Who.
But it's really mid-70s forward is the lion's share. And a lot of the music that I actually missed when it was out, I wasn't listening to that music in the '80s. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, but I'm a host of a show and I put creative content in between the music. So it's, I'm having a blast.
That's
cool. Really am enjoying it. And it's a great gig. It's a cool thing to be able to do. And I'm in Nashville. You know, when I'm on the road, I can do it. You know,
yeah,
we're recording this sitting on your couch, and
yeah,
I can record my segments, or I can connect live on a piece of machinery that's the size of your laptop, and you think I'm in a radio studio. I can do it from a dressing room or a hotel room.
I love that.
So it's fucking great. And then Trigger Hippie's album Full Circle and Then Some just came out last Friday. I don't say this is my finest hour ever, but I will say I'm as proud of this album and I love this album as much as any I've ever been involved with in the past. And it was a blast to make it. We took our time. The older I get, the more patient I get. And I'm just, you know, I really dig where the band is right now. And we're out the first week of November playing shows. First night is at Levon's Barn in Woodstock.
Sick.
And, we'll be working a lot next year, and I'm just, every musical itch I have, Trigger Hippie more than scratches.
That's fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, so the book is out right now. Everybody get that. And I do have one funny thought to tell you. As soon as we turned off the mics last time, you said, oh, I got to tell you this Jimmy Page story. And you left me that nugget, and I'm not
going to... Oh, I did?
Oh, yeah, you told me that nugget as funny. You were leaving in the driveway, and I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah, that was interesting.
I think that particular story has baffled my mind, being my favorite bands being Zeppelin and then Black Crowes. If I looked at in AC/DC, those are the three that I probably listened to more than anything in my life.
Right.
To hear that story, and I'm not going to give it away, people, because you got to read the book, you fucking lazy assholes, or the audio book.
Hook a brother up. Buy a book, wouldn't you?
Yeah, buy a book, man, or the audio. The audio is great. Steve does the audio. But this Jimmy Page story is unbelievable. But I do love to talk to you because you are a guy who played with Jimmy Page, man.
Yeah.
You know,
well, this is true.
And I just talked about it last week on my bonus episode. Jimmy has not played guitar other than the Zeppelin
02. He hasn't been on the road since 2000 with us.
This guy has never jammed with anybody. He hasn't played in the studio on stuff.
He's hopped up on stage a handful of times. He sat in with us in 2011.
Right,
in
I
London.
Read that. That was great. Yeah.
He's done a few of those, but no, there's been no. They did the Zeppelin thing in 2007.
Yeah.
And then he and John Paul Jones and Jason were thinking about continuing for few months.
Yeah.
They pulled the plug by the spring of 08 on that one.
Yep.
And to the best of my understanding, yeah, that's it. I mean, I don't know that he's done anything
it's
else.
Wild,
I mean,
right?
Live or in the studio. I'm sure he has done stuff in the studio. You know, the way you just put ideas down and all that.
Yeah.
He's always, I'm sure, got that. But yeah, I don't know of anything else.
I think it would just be
I tell you what, if in 2000, if you'd said, you know, he was only, in the year 2000, he was... like 55.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and of course at 35, I'm like, he's getting up there, but now I'm 54 right now.
You know, I'm 53.
Like,
and I'm like,
yeah, if you had told me then, by the way, he's never hitting a tour again. I would have never in a million years thought that possible.
It was crazy to think about how you said that the first night at the Greek, he kind of choked. And then the second night he just destroyed.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's so weird to say, he choked, what that means is he just wasn't ascendant. He was still good. But you know, but we had had a couple nights with him, and then the second night at the Greek was one where it's like, I used to say, like, man, this cape just comes out and he's just Superman. You know, it's just like, it just all of a sudden, like, he just gets this, you can see this charge overtake him, and he would just go. And it was in his eyes. You know, it really was very real, like this visceral thing. It'd be like, oh, fuck, there he goes, man. Let's go.
That's fucking killer.
Yeah, it was great.
All right, I'm going to leave you on this. I'm going to say this, and I say this over and over in the last month of nonstop emails. It doesn't give a fuck to me who plays in the Black Crowes when they go out. If you don't want to see it, just don't buy a ticket. If you do, buy a ticket. But my thought is, go find the new Black Crowes and fall in love with them, which I have over and over, like Marcus King Band, Rival Sons, lots of bands out there. You don't need to get caught up in the drama of how come this isn't in that. Just don't go or go.
You know, I'm glad you said that. I'm going to make a recommendation, a band called Illiterate Light.
Illiterate Light.
They're fucking fantastic. And their first album just came out on Friday on Atlantic Records.
Oh, I'm going to check it.
And full disclosure, the singer guitarist is my nephew.
Oh.
That's not why I'm recommending it.
Oh, that's right. You told me about this.
They are just, they're going to, my prediction, I'm putting the house on in a couple of years. No one will not know who this band is.
Oh.
He's a special, special talent. It's a two-man band. My nephew Jeff and his partner Jake, this drummer, they're connected at the hip. They've been best friends for 10 years. They met in college. They've been playing together since they were 18, 19 years old. And great songs, great performers, great record. They, you know, everything about them. I was doing what I could to shepherd them and bring them along. And, you know, a couple years ago, one day I finally went, guys, I'm done.
Yeah.
Just there's nothing left for me to say. Just don't stop.
Yeah.
You can't take this any further. You're going to write better songs, but everything else is ready. Like, just don't quit.
Don't quit.
And it's all just happened. And
that's what Burr said to me.
And they are, I'm telling you right now, go see them live if you get the chance. You might say you don't like it, but you will respect it. But you'll like it. Great, hard as shit, melodic, great melodies, great lyrics, wonderful musicians, both of them. It's very, very real.
Yeah, that's fucking cool.
And Burr was right. I've only seen you do comedy once.
Yeah.
With Bill at the Ryman.
Oh, yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
And I think I told you this, and it might not have come across in the way I meant, but you as a comedian, I know you as a guy, as a fan and as a friend. I mean, a fan of rock,
of
and
course.
Then as my buddy. And your enthusiasm and all this stuff, and I was wondering how that was going to come across. But your comedy, it took me by surprise, and I don't know how to really explain it, but it's that, well, it's like when my nephew goes, come see my band. You're like, you don't realize it till you're relieved.
Oh,
you're like, I really like this guy so much. I hope I like his thing. And I was so happy because you were fucking great.
Oh,
and I was
man.
Like, oh, thank God, Dean is so good.
Because
I didn't realize, I mean, I was excited to see it.
But of course.
Like and same thing, like when Jeff's like, hey, so it's just two of us now, because the band was five and then it was four. They kept losing members. And he goes, well, it's just me and Jake, but I think this is it. Actually, it's supposed to be. And I remember going to see him like, oh, fuck, here we go. But I was like, oh, no, guys, this is totally the thing. And when I saw you at the Ryman, I was like, and you've been doing it for years, but to me, you're a brand new comic.
I am a brand new comic, so 10
years. But I was like proud. I was like, fucking Dean's killing it up there. It's fucking great. It was awesome, dude.
I love you, dude.
Yeah.
And I can't. Like, I don't play rock at all anymore, but if I did, I would definitely find a way to...
Well, motherfucker, you're playing some AC/DC songs again.
We're doing that again. We're doing that, and it's going to be...
That's got to happen.
It's going to be the 40-year anniversary of Bon Scott's death, and it's the...
Oh, no shit.
Yep, and it's the 40-year anniversary of Back in Black.
February 19th.
Yeah, so...
Or is it the 20th? It's the 19th.
It's the 19th. And we will do the Highway to Hell tour set list.
Oh, fuck it. Well, okay, so we actually have a plan.
Well, I'm kind of putting
it
together.
You're laying
it
down right now.
Yeah,
awesome.
I'm kind of putting it together.
February, I'm in LA. All right, I look forward to it.
February or March, we just got to get the right guys, everybody. That's the only hard part. Okay,
dude.
Circle these. But you are the man. I cannot wait to
I'm on it.
Play with you again. And also, It was so funny because you go, yeah, man, when I did it, I hadn't played drums in like a year. You crushed it. I love looking back at you on Let There Be Rock, which is the last.
I'd been playing, yeah. But I hadn't played a gig like that. Like a hard rock gig. You got to go. So all I'm thinking the whole time is just like, man, I think I need to start playing some more gigs. You know, like it was fine. The next day, I thought it was fine. I did wake up the next day, and I was like, oh, my rock neck is stiff. You know, that's what it is. It was great.
Yeah, you killed it, man.
It was fun.
And, you know, my buddy Ronnie Crawford did it for years, and then he kills. And you two, I swear, are twin brothers from another mother, man. Yeah. The feel, the vibe. I love your vibe when I look back. Yeah. It's great to look back and just see you. Like, I can't imagine being Chris and look back and have to see another guy, because when you're back there and you're just laying down these great grooves, I'm like, this is the fucking man. That was getting me off.
You gotta dig a ditch back there,
you
baby.
You gotta, dude.
the plumbing don't go without a ditch.
Yeah. All right, guys, get the book and follow him on Instagram, which is Steve
like _ Gorman _.
Yep.
And then Twitter is SGSFox, SGSFOX.
And then listen to
which, by the way, yeah. I would change, but then they always say you lose the blue mark and you don't get it back.
Yeah.
Does it even fucking matter?
I know.
I don't know. People keep going like, no, keep the verification.
Yeah.
Whatever. It's easy to find.
Yeah.
I'm easy to find.
And then listen to his new radio show. I'm pretty excited. I think I'm going to be on that one day.
You will be.
Yep. And we love you guys. Thanks for tuning in. And like I said, go out there and listen to some new music and get your own favorite band.
I recommend Trigger Hippie and Illiterate Light. Thank you very much.
There you go, guys. Candles lit. Oh, also one last thing. Hey, do you use CBD?
No.
I got some CBD for you.
I'm about to start using it.
Yeah, apparently. It doesn't get you high or anything.
No, it's fine. If it's good for what ails you, I need something.
Yeah, joint aches, anxiety, whatever. CBDLion.com. Use the code DEAN for 20% off. I love you guys. Candles lit.